Tick 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 tick. And then it'll go tick 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 tick, and it'll reset back to the top, and then tick 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 tick.
That's Susan Rogers, a sound engineer who's worked with musicians like David Byrne, Gigi Ta, Tricky, and most famously Prince on his albums Purple Rain and Sign of the Times. Susan Rogers is one of the most legendary female sound engineers in an industry long dominated by men. These days, she's also a professor at the Berklee School of Music, where she researches psychoacoustics. That's the study of how our brains process sound. She's interested in how we remember sound and how our minds perceive music.
It's pleasant on a number of levels. It's rhythmic, and I think it's right about the right tempo for human preferences, not too fast, not too slow. It's kind of broadband noise. It's kind of white noisy with a little bit of emphasis on the top end. And it's been a long time since I've walked on a nice lawn, walked through a nice lawn sprinkler. You see the water diffusing through the sky, and you see it landing on the blades of grass. Humans are really good at extracting a pulse out of those kinds of things. Sound is a special form of touch. I recorded a sprinkler one day when I just happened to notice how good it sounded, so I had my recorder with me and I pressed the button and picked up that tick 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 tick. I don't remember exactly which song we used it on, but we had so many samples. We would use sound effects records that included turkeys and included puppies. A little kennel full of puppies is a very evocative and exciting sound. A little bit too exciting, really, to be useful. I stay with my dentist, because I love the music she plays in her office. She plays jazz and bebop, and I'm happy to stay in that dentist's office for a long time because the music is so great. In contrast, I have changed dentists when their music in their offices was really, 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 really bad. People who choose music just because it feels good and they want it on in the background are doing the exact thing that they evolved to do, which is choose a stimulus that pleases you and move on. Some of us just get deeper into it than others. Prince used to refer to your musical home base as the street where you live. So I personally was born on Soul Street, Soul and R&B. That's the street I live on. I'll go visit some other streets. I'll go visit Rock. I have friends who live on Rock, and I'll go visit them. But I always come back to my home base. In that sense, music has more in common with food for this development of likes and dislikes, and the fact that we can encounter the same, exact same stimulus over and over and over and over again. And if we really like it, we don't get bored of it. That's unique. That makes music unique among the art forms.
As a sound engineer and music psychologist, Rogers explores the way sound changes our minds, shifts our attitudes, and even affects us physically. We'll hear more from Susan Rogers on the sound of sprinklers, Prince, pleasure, and the brain later in the show. But first, let's look at another example of the relationship between sound and the body. Our producer, Ross Simonini, was suffering from nagging chronic pain for years, and he could never figure out what was causing it. Then he discovered a healing therapy that used only the human voice to treat pain. And it helped. Here's Ross Simonini.
This is side one of the first tape of the stress reduction and relaxation program that you have joined. By playing this tape regularly, you are assuming an active and powerful role in improving your health.
I'd been having pains in my stomach, nausea, aching throbs, an angry growing pressure, like my internal organs were being slowly inflated to the point of explosion. This was all day, every day. Inflammation, the doctors called it. But I didn't know where it came from. Over several years, I'd tried to address the problem by exploring every form of medicine I could think of. Acupuncture, antibiotics, Ayurveda, just to name the A's. But none of it helped. A friend told me she'd found hypnotherapy effective for some of her own health problems. And since it was one of the few treatments I hadn't tried, I called and made an appointment to go under.
Feeling your feet on the ground, touching the consoles around you, the buttons, the monitors, the switches, the dials.
Using your imagination now, I'd like you to imagine a kind of mission control. A place with an enormous supercomputer, the kind of place that might launch a space shuttle. And just let me know when you can see this place in your mind.
This is the voice that brought me under. The voice that might enter my mind, dive into my guts, and heal whatever was going on down there. Daniel Ryan is a New York-based hypnotherapist, which means he uses hypnosis to heal people. And he does it by speaking, just as he is in this recording, which was made during one of my sessions with him.
This place is a kind of supercomputer of you, a kind of mission control. And in it, these buttons and these dials control various processes. Emotional, physical, mental, physiological, neurological. I'd like you to find the dial for that inflammation in this place. It might currently be set around a 4 or a 5. And just let me know when you have found it.
As Ryan spoke, I was reclining in my chair in his dimly lit office. My limbs grew heavy, and everything became warm and comfortable and quiet. The feeling was subtle. I didn't lose consciousness or control of my faculties. I could still choose my words when I spoke. It was simply a deep relaxation, and I always felt at any moment that I could snap out of it. But there are varying depths of the hypnotic state, some of which are quite potent. Years ago, when I was at my high school's graduation after party, I personally saw a hypnotist, the entertaining kind, casually convince close friends of mine to act like radically different people, crying and losing their minds over the most absurd, inconsequential things. But hypnosis has also been reputedly used as an anesthetic in surgery, and anecdotally has helped many people get over addiction. So I knew it held some kind of power, and maybe that could help me.
Just to experiment, and just to see what happens. Temporarily, I would like you to dial the discomfort up to about a 7. We are in control of it. We can turn it up. We can intensify it. I'd like you to bring it down now to a 4 or a 3 and let me know when you can feel that response.
Hypnotherapy is a form of psychosomatic healing, which means the mind is affecting the body. Many people still consider psychosomatic medicine a pseudoscience because, historically, Western medicine has treated the mind and body as though they were utterly independent, like feuding neighbors who interacted only when absolutely necessary. But mind-body medicine is being used more often these days by Western doctors like John Sarno, who famously claims his book, Healing Back Pain, can cure a patient simply by being read and understood. And hypnotherapy is especially popular for treating digestive pain. In the medical field, the stomach is increasingly being called the second brain, or the enteric nervous system. It's filled with all sorts of neurons and contains much of our serotonin, a crucial neurotransmitter that's responsible for stabilizing our mood. The mind and the stomach are inextricably connected, and the pathway between them is known in the medical community as the gut-brain axis. But unlike other forms of gastrointestinal medicine, which require drugs, surgery, and invasive tests, hypnosis attempts to heal a patient by only using the tool of the human voice.
I sometimes think of my role as a hypnotherapist when I'm working with somebody in session, or the role of my voice, I should say. Ideally, the client would at a point fail to distinguish my voice from the voice inside their head. And as much as I am speaking, I also want to be actively listening at the same time, you know, really listening to the sound and tone of my voice as I'm speaking. I'm doing it right now. I don't have to think to speak to you. I can just do it. The voice rises up out of my chest effortlessly if I just allow it to.
Be there, first person, feeling your feet on the ground.
Pacing, tone, pitch, timbre, all of these elements of audio, you know, they all matter. They all come into play, and they all have a place. Slowing down speech will have a natural effect. Speeding it up will be something really effective too, you know? So it's like just playing with it and using it as an instrument is really what it's all about. So being spontaneous with the person in the chair and seeing what's needed at that time. For instance, I might use a tone of voice, a certain tone of voice, to discuss the problem. And then I'll use another tone of voice to discuss the solution. Sometimes I will just audibly take a deep breath. And that says enough right there. You know, I will see my client do the same thing just because they heard me do it.
During our sessions, Ryan spoke to me about my condition and my life. It felt like psychoanalysis, but he also spoke about the history and techniques of hypnosis. The way he had come to use his voice by studying masters of vocal induction. The method of placing someone into a trance with the sound of the voice alone. He did this so that I could have a better understanding of the field, because he knew the more comfortable he made me with his process, the more I would accept his induction.
There's reason to believe in ancient Egypt and in ancient Greece, there were places called sleep chambers. And in fact, the word hypnosis is derived from Greek. Hypnos and gnosis, meaning sleep and knowledge, or sleeping knowledge, which might even be another way of saying subconscious. So in these sleep chambers, there were something like very early guided meditations or satsangas, where you would have groups come together that would have these healing experiences that were guided by a speaker, that were guided by somebody's voice.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare.
Hypnosis is an ancient concept, but hypnotherapy was born as a contemporary practice in the 1960s. Thanks to a man named Milton Erickson. Erickson began developing his influential methods as a teenager when he was diagnosed with polio. He was paralyzed, unable to speak, and eventually comatose. His doctor told the family that he would die within a few days. But Erickson claims that when he came back to consciousness, he began experimenting with self-hypnosis. He developed a new kind of sensitivity and learned to place himself into a dreamlike state where he could recall his memories of muscle activity. He was internally activating that part of his brain. After 2 years of this, he had recovered almost fully. He was walking and speaking and taking 1,000-mile canoe trips. He went on to live for another 50 years. He developed a technique that he called indirect suggestion, where he used stories and conversational speech to place his patients into a hypnotic state. Here's Erickson speaking to a group of hypnotherapists, teaching them how to use their own voice.
Now don't try to imitate my voice or my cadence. Just discover your own. Be your own natural self.
Ryan sees Erickson as one of his greatest influences, and he often spoke about him to me.
I think he's the father of modern hypnotherapy. He was known for his stories, and sometimes his trances. There was never once, not one single direct suggestion, you know, that somebody would be there for anxiety or something like this. And Erickson would just lapse into a story about, you know, going to get the newspaper and petting the dog and working with his family or something like this. And there would be endless embedded suggestions in his tone of voice.
How much are you willing to learn?
Well, I'm very willing. I'm a little nervous, though.
You're a little nervous? Well, really, I have to be the one who's nervous. Because I've got to do the work, and all you have to do is let things happen. And it will happen.
You know, I mean, he's there next to Freud and Jung in my mind. One of my favorite stories about him, he had one client who was seeing him and who was having trouble affording the sessions. He said, well, all right, I will agree to keep seeing you at no cost if you promise to get better. I've used this model before, and I can tell you it works. Because when you create a positive expectation of healing, that's placebo. It's like a doctor in a white coat comes to me that I trust as an authority and says, Dan, you're going to get better. And I take a deep sigh of relief because I've just heard from this person that I perceive as an authority that he knows me well enough that he knows I'm going to get better. So now I can rest. And my body responds. My physiology responds to that. It starts to get better.
Erickson was tapping into a trance that exists in all humans. A state that runs parallel to our waking lives all day long. He just found his own way to enter it. He's bridging the mind and the body, using placebo and psychosomatic suggestion to nudge the body toward a state of wellness that it wants to achieve. He just wants to get the mind out of the body's way. He's simply trying to get us to communicate with ourselves.
I believe trance to be as old as the human mind. You know, it's the most deeply human, fundamental, natural thing. I have a friend who is a colleague and also a hypnotherapist who's a new mother, and we were in her car recently, and her child was in the back seat crying, wailing. The poor thing was, you know, in one of those inconsolable rages that infants will sometimes experience. And the only thing that can calm her down when she's in that state is her mom, my friend Cheryl, singing, of all things, Lollipop. The old song from the 50s, you know? And so she begins to sing this song. I join in with her, and we start singing to the baby, and she starts calming down.
Lollipop, lollipop, oh, lollipop, lollipop, oh, lollipop, lollipop, oh, lollipop.
Nothing but her mother's voice, you know, singing this thing, you know, a human who has no speech yet, but her mother's voice can soothe her.
We'll dive deeper into the history of hypnosis after a quick break. And now we return to our exploration of hypnotherapy. Here's Ross Simonini.
Trance induction isn't simply confined to therapy. It's a technique used by parents, musicians, teachers, orators, anyone who wants their audience in a state of calm reception.
You know, one could argue, you know, that a mass, a Catholic mass for the devout could be entrancing, and that the words of a priest, you know, could put the congregation into a certain kind of trance.
Ideas are very powerful. It's not only emotions that are powerful in human life.
That's Alan Watts, a religious scholar known for his meditative lectures and for the smooth British tenor he used to deliver them.
Psychoanalysis has, of course, examined the emotional bases of human opinions and beliefs, but one should also examine the intellectual bases of psychological principles, or theories, or therapies.
I can just listen to him speak and zone out, and it's like the fifth time I finally hear the words he's using, you know, and I mean, I get something different out of it all the time. So there's no question that he's putting me in a trance when I'm listening to him speak. I think any teacher will, too, which brings me to the point, the most powerful healing states, I also believe, to always be learning states.
Trance is also an entertaining state. As my sessions with Brian went on, I enjoyed the private performances he was giving with his voice. It's an art form, and so it follows that many artists have used it. One that Ryan points to is the magician David Blaine.
Hold the deck. You're thinking of a card? Do I know what card you're thinking of? Your card just left the deck just now.
When you listen to interviews with David Blaine, he usually speaks incredibly slowly. Incredibly slowly, and has a very deep tone of voice, and can sometimes seem like he's about to fall asleep mid-sentence. He's putting people in trances. There's no question he knows what he's doing.
Look through the deck. Your card isn't there. Go ahead and look. Yeah, it's not there. You won't see it there. No, it's nowhere.
It's an excellent sound. When we hear the bell, we practice listening to the bell deeply. We go back to our breath. Listen. We breathe in. This wonderful sound brings me back to my true home. We breathe out.
This isn't technically hypnosis. It's the voice of Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh giving a Dharma talk, part of a longer guided meditation. But Ryan sees deep similarities between the two practices, and he borrows from meditation traditions. And that's how our sessions felt to me, like quiet, intimate conversations with my subconscious.
The separations between a guided meditation, a hypnotic induction, a guided imagery or guided visualization, all of these names for very similar experiences.
As Ryan and I moved forward over our many sessions, my trances became increasingly vivid. My stomach wasn't healing exactly, but I felt good during the sessions, and I was beginning to notice connections between my mind and my body, the way certain moods would affect the level of pain I was experiencing. In one of our last sessions, after I had settled into this process a bit and had developed some faith in it, Ryan presented me with the final step of his method, past life regression.
In a series of trance states, Catherine recalled past life memories that proved to be the causative factors of her symptoms. She also was able to act as a conduit for information from highly evolved spirit entities, and through them she revealed many of the secrets of life and of death.
This is the voice of Brian Weiss, reading his book Many Lives, Many Masters, which brought past life regression to popularity in the 80s.
In just a few short months, her symptoms disappeared, and she resumed her life, happier and more at peace than ever before.
The reincarnation practice that Weiss describes doesn't need to be interpreted literally. Past lives could also be called possible lives or fictional lives. And the stories that emerge are like exercises for the imagination.
In past life regression, you have the intention of accessing what may or may not be past lifetimes, presumably to access useful information on the origin of a phobia or a relationship or some resource that we're looking to bring into the present to enrich our lives. Yeah, maybe these are memories of past lifetimes we're exploring, and that is deeply important information for us to examine and look at. But it's also very clear that these experiences are metaphorical for certain themes in our lives that are dominating in the present. And that points to the possibility that maybe these experiences are communicating to us through layers of meaning and metaphor and symbology, not unlike the way a dream might communicate to us. Symbolic reasoning being embedded in our intelligence. We rely on symbolic reasoning to understand language, the set of symbols that we think, dream, and speak in, to understand money and currency. So I like talking about past life regression from that expansive point of view where, hey, we can have this experience now. It may be a past lifetime. It may not be. Is the story useful to you? The narrative that rises up, what is that? What are the archetypes there? What do they mean to you? What are the feelings that are present? So it's also a very powerful creative tool. I love working with artists using past life regression because essentially what we're doing is accessing this storytelling machine inside the unconscious, and these wild narratives rise up.
When Ryan regressed me, I found myself in a slot canyon as a young girl, alone, running from a group of men in the distance. Whether this was based on westerns I'd seen or the recent trip I'd taken to Colorado, I don't know. But the narrative did emerge. I didn't actively make it, but once I saw it, Ryan helped me to open it up and unpack the details. Like a lucid dream, like a movie I was intuitively filming. Ryan had me fast forward time and watch this woman, years later, on her deathbed as she was dying. It was as affecting as any film, as a book, as any good story.
We're poking at the mystery here. That's like the thing that to me is the next wave of understanding for us, where we're headed scientifically, medically, philosophically, culturally, is to a finer understanding of narrative on a cellular level, a finer understanding of how and where these stories come from.
I went into a different story for each of my final sessions, and the only way I got there was through the sound of a voice, which in itself felt miraculous. I continued to notice that during these experiences, my stomach wasn't hurting, which meant when I stepped away from consciousness, I could step away from physical pain. Hypnotherapists believe that all hypnosis is self-hypnosis, that you can only engage with the practice if you want to, or if you need to. In this way, you are ultimately healing yourself. For me, hypnotherapy wasn't a quick fix. It didn't cure me, but it showed me that health could literally be a state of mind, and that the human body can be guided by nothing more than a voice to help itself.
You can find out more about the hypnotherapist Daniel Ryan at DanielRyanCRT.com. We'll be back with a new episode, as usual, in 2 weeks. However, next week, we'll post an appendix to this episode, where Daniel Ryan made a hypnotic induction recording just for us. So subscribe to The Organist and look for the appendix episode in our feed next week. And probably best to make sure you're not operating heavy machinery when you listen to that one. And now, let's return to the sound engineer and music psychologist Susan Rogers.
It's evocative. It makes us think of pleasant days, nice sunny weather, and it may soon be a nostalgic sound. I guess now with global warming and with having to conserve water, we might not be hearing lawn sprinklers as often as we used to. So I like it on a number of levels. If you just close your eyes sometimes and listen, you'll be probably pleasantly surprised at how delightful and calming or arousing or exciting or innovative or familiar the sonic landscape can be. It was interesting to be part of a profession where there weren't many exemplars who looked like me. When I started in the music business in 1978, there were very few women. So I couldn't dress like a typical female engineer because there was no such thing. There were so few of them. So then that brings up the dilemma. Well, what should I look like? Should I just look like the men? What does an engineer look like? I made a bad choice when I was 17 and I got married. And turns out that I actually made a better choice than I realized, because the person I married had the good fortune for me to be a really terrible person. And because he was a really terrible person and used to beat me up, that meant that I could escape him without any guilt. If I had married a good man, it that wouldn't have turned out that way. But it turns out that I had the foresight to marry a really bad man. So when I was 21, I was able to get away. And then I embarked on my career and never looked back. I have been a Prince fan for many, many years. I loved his music before I went to work for him, while I was working for him, and after I stopped working for him. You couldn't work with him as a fan because you'd be too starstruck to actually work. That tells us, it suggests, that if this is doable, then that means the liking and the love for music must be processed in a slightly different region of the brain than the cognitive assessment. Just like a chef gets into his career because he loves food, but what would it be like if he lost that? I could imagine it would take a lot of the joy out of living. You have to be able to just eat a sandwich sometimes, and then other times you devote your love for food to your profession. Right now, the record I'm enjoying is Father John Misty, Pure Comedy. I love Father John Misty because I love his lyrics especially. I like the way the man turns a phrase.
The comedy of man starts like this. Our brains are way too big for our mother's hips. And so nature, she devised this alternative. We emerge half-formed and hope whoever greets us on the other end is kind enough to fill us in.
That piece was produced by Jenny and Mint. The organist is produced by me with Ross Simonini. Our managing editor is Ben Bush. Our contributing editors are Jenny Amint, Naila Orr, David Weinberg, and Mike Dodge Weitzkopf. Our intern is the immortal Aaron Pelish. Our editor at KCRW is Nick White. We're engineered at KCRW by Mario Diaz and Kat Yore. If you like this podcast, or even if you just listen to this podcast, it would be great if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Many thanks this week to organist listener Eugene Lim, who did just that. He wrote this review, which recently appeared on the Apple Podcast page.
I haven't yet listened to the organist, but I can sense her moving around in my pocket, or absorbing the requisite energy from the skies. Even now, I can sense the organist seeking and finding permission to unlock a door and just enter my mind. Elon Musk says we're living in a simulation, so perhaps all this has already happened. The organist has already been here. I've listened to her already. Already she's appeared and poured into my mind her choices, but I just don't realize it yet. That's one theory. That's what science teaches us. Or the organist must needs be present all around me, and it's not a question of before or after. And the organist is always coming into being and going out of being, coming into being and going out of being, constantly and always and both simultaneously. That's also what science teaches us. Maybe Elon Musk's name outside the simulation is Melon Usk. He's chosen another name so as to instantiate himself into this universe as a signal. And it's up to me and me alone, or you and you alone, maybe you. It's up to you and you alone to confirm receipt of this signal and thus end the game. But how will you confirm receipt? Maybe through an iTunes podcast review. Is this what science teaches us? Melon Usk. Receipt of signal is confirmed. That's not what science teaches us. I haven't yet listened to the organist, but there are sweaty sounds I anticipate when I do. Sweaty sounds, and also I have the distinct premonition the air will smell strongly of pickles. The sweet, overwhelming odor of Vlasic sweet gherkins, or maybe Vlasic dill spears. And also the voluptuous dampness of a summer baseball cap when you nuzzle your nose inside of it. I think it's about to happen. The organist is over. The organist begins. The organist is here.
Thank you, Eugene. Eugene Lim is the author of the novels Fog and Car, The Strangers, and the forthcoming Dear Cyborgs. He also runs Ellipsis Press, and you can read his review on Apple Podcasts right after you post your own, or check out our email newsletter, which lies in a bed watching Prestige TV next to all of our past episodes right over there at kcrw.com/theorganist. Finally, I'd like to thank Joan Hurley Black, Gary Wachter, Carol Ott, Eric Hyman, and Natasha Boas. All of these people donated to our Kickstarter campaign 2 years ago, and for their reward, they chose to be thanked on this program, and I just realized that I couldn't remember if I had thanked all of them before, so just to be safe, I'm thanking them all again now. Thank you, guys. And to everybody else, thanks for listening.